Hi, Angie.
Hi, Nick. How are you? Good to be with you here again.
It's good to be with you too. I went out like a kid out clubbing last night, and I'm kind of recovering from that this morning, but it was a fun night. What about you? How are you?
I also was out late last night and I'm still recovering. I'm just not as young as I used to be. But it was a lot of fun. And we did see the Black Panther movie, the second one that just came out, and I thought it was so good. Have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't actually seen the first one either. I got to catch up.
Well, you know what? I'm not like a comic book person, so I'm sure anybody who's like a comic buff is going to really just maybe cringe at what I have to say. But out of all of the Marvel movies, I thought I loved the Black Panther movies, but especially the second one. I don't know if you knew anything about the plot, but the kind of main conflict in the second movie is that they have another community of people who has this prized possession of vibranium underneath the ocean. And it happens to be these kind of like Central American Mexican indigenous tribe. And it has roots in like in Maya mythology and things like that. Kukulkan is like an actual Maya god. And it was really exciting to see that on camera, in film.
Yeah, that's so cool. And that's like perfect for like what we're talking about today. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was really, I know it made an impact on a lot of the people in my community, but it also like, I mean, it's true what they say, representation is really impactful. So, yeah.
Yes, amen. Yes. So today we are going to continue our exploration of mysticism in Mexico by going down a path that will probably be familiar to a lot of people who are listening, but we're going to try our best to dispel any myth, and you'll see in a moment why that's a little bit tricky, and shed light on the infamous figure of La Santa Muerta. So before we dive into the research, I'm curious to know, Angie, what your understanding of Santa Muerta was before we researched this episode. Do you have any experiences directly or indirectly with Santa Muerta that you wouldn't mind sharing?
Yeah, I do. I do have some experience with Santa Muerte, although it's not from me working with her. Rather, it was a byproduct of someone who we considered to be a family friend. I say we, it's my family. So to this day, even though my parents wouldn't consider themselves to be overly superstitious, just a little stitious. When things go awry, there's like a glance that they share between them that's, they don't say anything, but it really says it all. There's still this feeling that we are still feeling the consequences of that. So while I haven't directly worked with Santa Muerte, I know that she's not to be trifled with, truffled with, sorry. I can't resist a pop culture reference. I ask my dad about it from time to time, and he'll say, in reference to this person and their workings with Santa Muerte, that he unequivocally believes in the power of curses. And I'm sure a lot of people in the Mexican American community might have a neighbor or a cousin or someone in their congregation who has a similar experience. And of course, there's like tons of art that depicts Santa Muerte. So there's even a Santa Muerte tarot deck floating around out there on the internet.
Have you seen that?
I have, yeah. I don't know, like I said, I don't have like a lot of personal experience with Santa Muerte, so I can't say like how I really feel about it. The art is cool. So yeah.
Yeah, and my kind of only touch point on this prior to doing this research with you was that I took a class on Memento Mori, and one of the weeks we covered Santa Muerta. We watched this really incredible documentary about it, and what really drew me personally to it is the way that it has shown up for the LGBTQIA plus community and sex worker community, and just for the marginals. Like, honestly, it's sort of a goddess or saint figure to work with when you're working in the marginal space. So of course, that interests me. But yeah, let's I'm getting ahead. So let's dive in, shall we?
Yes, of course. Let's do it. So, according to Michelle Teles, an associate professor for the Department of Mexican American Studies in the University of Arizona's College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, Día de los Muertos, which occurs annually November 1st and 2nd, is a time for people to mourn the loss of family members and friends and to ensure they're never forgotten. History.com traces the celebration back to the Aztec, also known as the Mexica people, who used skulls to honor the dead a millennium before the Day of the Dead celebrations emerged. Skulls, like the ones placed on Aztec temples, remain a key symbol in the tradition of those who celebrate the festival, a tradition that has continued for more than six centuries in an annual celebration to honor and commune with those who've already passed on. Echoing what we shared in our previous episode on Mexican folklore and cartomancy, Teles explains that when the Spanish arrived in Mexico, they brought the religion of Christianity and more specifically Catholicism with them. In a way, it is celebrated today. Dia de los Muertos syncretizes the All Saints Day or All Souls Day and the original Aztec ritual known as Micahuitl.
Customs and traditions associated with the Dia de los Muertos often include the building of home altars called ofrendas, where offerings to deceased loved ones are placed. Candles light photos of those who have passed, and families may read letters and poems and tell stories and jokes about the dead. Offerings of tamales, chiles, water, tequila, and pan de muerto, a specific bread for the occasion, are lined up by bright orange and yellow, help me with this pronunciation.
Cempasúchil.
Or marigolds, whose strong scent helps guide the souls home. Actually, I'm going to stop for a second because I was curious if you, did you do any of this growing up with your family?
No, we actually we didn't really do it growing up. I was, not to give myself too much credit, but I was the one who actually said I would love to do this and partake in this ritual. And so it wasn't until just maybe 5 or 6 years ago that my family started to bring it back. And I've actually really loved watching my dad partake in it. It's been really special too, because he's always had a love for genealogy, really kind of enjoy telling stories about his family. So yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I do remember in Spanish class, and when I was in elementary school, I remember celebrating this. Like, I remember our teacher kind of, we had a day. I can distinctly remember like turning the lights off, and like, I remember the flowers and like the food and all of that. I was just curious, like, how do you feel about that? Like, how, because I don't know actually the lineage of my Spanish teacher in elementary school. So I can't really say for sure if I was learning, if someone was teaching me this custom who actually had experience with it, you know, but I don't know, like, how do you feel about the idea of like in a public school setting with a lot of non-Mexican kids kind of celebrating this with maybe not a whole lot of actual understanding, or I don't know. How does that sit with you? I'm just curious.
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. I think that's really important. And I would say, of course, this is me also allowing space for that. Other people have a lot of feelings around like reclaiming their culture and so forth, like Latin America and Mexico are not a monolith. So there's that asterisk, but I would also say that Mexican people in general are very like warm and welcoming, and they love to share their culture. They love to welcome people in and are very like hospitable people. And so I've seen a lot of this kind of cross-cultural embrace of Dia de los Muertos, and I personally love it. Like, I think that if we could all kind of reach back into who we are ancestrally. And I know that's difficult with some people not having like blood relatives that they can connect to and so forth. But I think that there's such rich belonging there, even if they're not here, like on the, I guess, earthly plane. Sorry, that was a weird, cheesy phrase to say, but it's true.
Yeah, totally. Thank you. Mm-hmm. In his book, Death and the Idea of Mexico, Chilean-born Columbia University professor of anthropology, Claudio Lomnitz, writes, quote, "In Europe and the United States, the 20th century is generally characterized as the era of the denial of death. During Mexico's 20th century, on the contrary, a gay familiarity with death became a cornerstone of national identity. The nationalization of an ironic intimacy with death is a singularly Mexican strategy," end quote. The idea that death was Mexico's totem was first put forward by Spanish surrealist poet Juan Larrea in the 1940s. Since the 1920s, a number of Mexico's most renowned artists have considered a playful intimacy with death to be uniquely Mexican. By the 1940s, death, especially its representation as a playful, mobile, and often dressed-up skeleton, has become a recognizably Mexican sign.
Mm-hmm. Lomnitz locates the emergence of death as a national totem in the aftermath of the Mexican Revolution. He writes that, quote, a generation of revolutionaries took up the images of Aztec sacrifice, of the Aztec skull rack, and life and death as a whimsical couple, and found in them and in their ritual elaboration during the Days of the Dead a source of pride and a blueprint for Mexico's modernist revolution. For the artists of the 1920s, the symbolic valence of Mexicans' intimacy with death was antithetical to the violence of colonialism, imperialism, and the capitalist exploitation.
You know what this is reminding me of is why I love the combination of the emperor and the death card. Because exactly what that paragraph just said, because I feel like if you work with emperor as a colonial imperialist capitalist idea, which definitely I think it's important to say that emperor can be that, you know, then I feel like death is such a great antidote for that, you know, for this exact reason. So that's like the perfect summation of how I view those two cards relationship.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So writer Salvador Holguín offers important counterpoints to what he considers to be an oversimplification on the part of Lomnitz. An article entitled Empress and Lover, Personifying Death in Mexico, Holguín writes, attempting to provide a univocal explanation for this abundance of death imagery runs the risk of oversimplifying a rather rich and multi-layered cultural phenomenon. And Lomnitz's genealogical approach is testament to this fact, end quote. Holguín points to Lady Death, a romantic personification of death that he considers to be particularly ubiquitous in Mexican culture. This Lady Death, writes Holguín, is a character that haunts the country's imagination. She appears time to time in songs, illustrations, poems, proverbs, and colloquial expressions. There are dozens of names for her, including La Flaca, the skinny one, La Pelona, the bald one, two of the names used to refer to La Santa Muerte, or Saint Death, or the Holy Death, a folk saint worshipped in some of the areas in Mexico and in the United States.
According to an article by Livia Gershon titled, Who is Santa Muerta? The folk saint's first documented appearance as a venerated figure in Mexico came in a 1797 Inquisition report on so-called idolatrous practices by indigenous worshipers. Scholars hold divergent theories on her origins. Some connect her to pre-Hispanic death cult practices of the Americas merged with Catholicism. Others think she arose from Yoruba tradition, brought to the Caribbean by enslaved Africans, similar to Haitian Vodou and Cuban Santeria. There is a claim that she first appeared in the 19th century to a healer in Veracruz, the Mexican state with the strongest Caribbean influences. Still, other scholars insist that La Santa Muerta is a European archetype of death, tracing her origins to skeletal figures, such as La Parca, which gained prominence during the plagues and epidemics in medieval times and were later transported to the Americas. Santa Muerta is a personification of death. Unlike other saints who originated in Mexican folk Catholicism, Santa Muerta is not herself seen as a dead human being. She is associated with healing, protection, financial well-being, and assurance of a path to the afterlife.
According to Wikipedia, since 2001, there has been a meteoric growth in Santa Muerta belief, largely due to her reputation for performing miracles. I will pause right here and just say that in my research for this episode, this was like all over the place. People who venerate Santa Muerte were saying, like, if you are devoted to her, if you hold up to your end of the bargain, she will do many, many amazing things for you. She'll open roads for you. She'll, you know, vanquish your enemies, was kind of like a common thread that I found there, but really, really interesting. Worship has been made up of roughly 2 million adherents, mostly in the state of Mexico, Guerrero, Veracruz, Tamaulipas, Campeche, Morelos, and Mexico City, with a recent spread to Nuevo León. And in the late 2000s, the founder of Mexico City's first Santa Muerte church, David Romo, estimated that there were around 5 million devotees in Mexico, constituting of approximately 5% of the country's population.
She's become particularly popular among members of more marginalized communities, such as sex workers, those who have been incarcerated, and members of the LGBTQIA+ community.
And in an article titled La Santa Muerte in Mexico City, The Cult and Its Ambiguities, which appeared in August of 2015 in the edition of the Journal of Latin American Studies, an explorative ethnographic researcher and teacher, Regnar Christensen, writes, quote, The allegation that La Santa Muerte is a patron saint of criminals has caught the attention of journalists, novelists, and American and Mexican experts alike. By labeling her the patron saint of criminals, they are somehow claiming that death has become their holy defender. These journalists and some scholars have largely focused on how infamous criminals might have used La Santa Muerte in sacrificial rites to plead for her protection, end quote. La Santa Muerte has gained an especially strong following from the transgender community. According to the USA Today, quote, the civil rights organization Transgender Europe documented 247 killings of transgender people in Mexico between January 2008 and April of 2016. That's the second highest number in the world following Brazil, end quote.
The fact that the traditional Catholic Church rejects and condemns transgender people has compelled those same people to seek spiritual guidance and protection in unofficial icons, such as Santa Muerta, who reflect their own structurally precarious positions in society. Tomás Prower, award-winning Latinx author of books on multicultural magic and mysticism, writes, quote, La Santa Muerta is a non-judgmental deity who gives no preferential treatment, end quote. Prior to her more public worship emerging in the last two decades, Santa Muerta was worshipped clandestinely by those, quote, whose professions put their lives in constant danger, especially at night. Other than thieves and prostitutes, these included bartenders, taxi drivers, and mariachi players, end quote. By 2013, worshippers of Santa Muerta had grown to such a number that the Catholic Church could no longer ignore them. In 2013, Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi, the president of the Vatican's Pontifical Council for Culture, denounced the Santa Muerta practice as, quote, sinister and infernal, calling it a, quote, blasphemy of religion.
Wow. That's big feelings.
Right. Yeah. Also, it's interesting. This is kind of reminding me of, I mean, I think we mentioned this earlier, but it really is reminding me of the plague, and the way that death really was thought of as this like equalizer. Mm-hmm. You know, and in that Memento Mori class that I took, we talked about the dance macabre, mm-hmm. which was almost this sort of, you know, death was almost like a comical figure that just, you know, is like, no matter how high up on the totem pole you are, you know, kings and monarchs, you know, you're all kind of brought down to the same level playing field when death, you know, comes along. And again, there's that emperor death, you know, kind of connection. So it's interesting. It's interesting to think of death in that way as being on the side of the impoverished, which also in a more tender way, you know, is sort of, it is a little bittersweet because those who are marginalized are more likely to die mm-hmm. sooner, you know, like are more likely to die young. And so then for death to be seen as like a friend to those who come to it more quickly, mm-hmm. And those who even in a way are less able to run away from it, you know, mm-hmm. that have less access to medicine, less access to healthcare, they sort of have to befriend death in a way that maybe those who are richer can kind of try to outrun death and therefore not learn how to befriend it. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah, really. It just feels like a very radical acceptance of death. Radical mm-hmm. acceptance, if anything, probably feels very true to Santa Muerte herself, yeah. At least as far as I've been able to learn. Both the Mexican and American governments are also cracking down on the cult of Santa Muerte. A 2013 FBI law enforcement bulletin featured a three-part series on Santa Muerte written by epochal warfare studies scholar Robert J. Bunker, who called Santa Muerte the bad girl counterpart to the Virgen de Guadalupe. The report goes on to say, quote, evidence suggests a rise in deviant spirituality and that drug traffickers may worship a perverted Christian god and various unsanctioned saints such as Jesús Malverde, Juan Soldado, and Santa Muerte. For those who may feel condemned to death, Santa Muerte represents a release from bondage. David Metcalf writes, quote, she represents a very real enemy to the power of death as a negative force. All areas of liminal resistance represent a breach in the world order, and those forces in place to maintain that order reach with varying levels of violence towards anything that threatens their position, transgender individuals, strong women, and heterodox devotional traditions. This is the threat that Santa Muerte poses to the current social structure and why mainstream media, orthodoxies, and officials all react with such disgust and abhorrence to her presence in the world. It's really interesting because in preparation to this episode, I went through a bunch of videos on YouTube of folks who work with Santa Muerte as a deity in their own spiritual practices. Although it feels like every single person kind of has their own flavor, their own gospel of absolutes when it comes to do's and don'ts of venerating her, it seems like there are a couple of common threads. First, that you've got to be really serious about your devotion. If you want to work with her, many of her devotees stated that they have devoted themselves for life. And so the commitment doesn't come lightly. Her devotees, though, even though like Santa Muerte has a very dark and severe reputation, they seem to all have wonderful experiences with her and even refer to her as a caring mother figure. Something I found across many of the videos I watched was the very strict ritual everyone seemed to have for their altars, for their prayers, and for their offerings to her. I also noted that you shouldn't try or can't really try to remove Santa Muerte from her Catholic context, and to do so is very disrespectful, which I found interesting. I kind of wonder if part of why marginalized communities gravitate towards Santa Muerte is because they don't feel safe within like the religious structure. Mm-hmm. But to venerate Santa Muerte outside of her Catholic context would be really disrespectful. I found that interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially because she is like a folk saint. What comes to mind to me when I hear the word folk is that it's a highly customizable figure to the person or people practicing. So whether they identify as being religious or maybe the degree of religious piety, I thought it was really interesting to hear that they venerate her in a way that's very by the book, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, it's that constant struggle that I definitely feel as a queer person of, you know, wanting to, it's on the one hand, should I just like abandon this thing that doesn't want me completely? Or on the other hand, should I queer it and find my own way into it, you know, and Santa Muerte provides a way to sort of find a queer way into Catholicism, mm-hmm. you know, if you feel like you don't want to just abandon it completely. But I feel like at least for me, I'm always, you know, six one way, half dozen the other with that, you know.
Yeah, it wouldn't be Nick if it wasn't that.
That's true. Speaking of books, J. Allen Cross has a great chapter on Santa Muerte in his book, American Brujeria, including a hefty word of caution if you're considering working with her. He makes a point to mention that although Santa Muerte might be a taboo figure, even in spiritual circles, because of her wrathful reputation, that Santa Muerte is not a goddess that is interchangeable with other deities like Hecate or Kali. They have their similarities, but each of them has a unique energy that deserves its own reverence. In the book, Jay talks about three different aspects of Santa Muerte Blanca, Santa Muerte Roja, and Santa Muerte Negra, meaning the white, the red, and the black, respectively. Santa Muerte Blanca, the white, is associated with purity, healing, and protection. And Jay says this is the version of Santa Muerte that you might get to know first. This is the most docile and motherly of the aspects, and she's said to be closest to her pre-Hispanic roots. Her areas of expertise are in ancestral connection and mediumship, road opening, healing illness, cleansing, and exorcism work. A few of her preferred offerings might be something like eggs, bowls of salt, Florida water, green apples, silver tequila, and white candles. Santa Muerte Roja, the red, is associated with matters of the flesh, blood, and carnal things, such as sex, love, war, and combat. She is, quote, known to be temperamental and quick to bite back should she suspect you are getting cheap and paying her enough attention, end quote. Her offerings might include things like jewelry, money, chocolate, red roses, and red wine.
With a segment of Santa Muerte Negra, the black, Jay hilariously says, quote, if you skip directly to this section, go back to the Blanca and start there, end quote. I think of all the things we might take away from this episode on Santa Muerte, that it's that Santa Muerte is serious business. As death incarnate, she does not hold loyalties or judgments in the same way that other deities might. As they say, death is the great equalizer. And when you work with Santa Muerte Negra, you're pulling out the big guns. She will grant big things for you, but you have to hold up on your end of the bargain too. Santa Muerte Negra is known as La Reina de las Brujas, or the Queen of the Witches. What a badass name.
Yeah.
Damn, put that on my resume. She is famous for striking down enemies, swift action, protection against hexes, and more. Her offerings might include things like dark chocolate, cigarettes, money, and black candles.
Well, this was amazing, Angie. Thank you so much for kind of spearheading this and leading us down this rabbit hole of history. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, I hope that you'll take a moment to leave us a rating and review. I know that we say this all the time, but it really does make a big difference. Other than just kind of being comforting to know that people are actually listening to what we're doing, it also really helps bump us up in the search engine, which just allows more people to discover the show. So if you have a time, please head over there and leave a little rating and review.
And if you would like to support the research and the work that goes into this podcast, we hope you'll support the show on Patreon, where you can enjoy weekly missive newsletters, discounted offerings, and invitations to attend our monthly tarot hangs, all for as little as $2 a month. Head over to patreon.com/insearchoftarot to join us today.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl underscore, that's BIRDGERHL underscore, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.